Malam Shri Varun Vaishnav Shashi Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Jubhishta Kipasandhviya Vajapati Chanam Pavanevya Vaishnavayu Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So it's May 22nd, 2021, 26 Second Avenue, over the internet, and we're reading from Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita Summarized, Text 51. So, can you give me the ability to share my screen, please? Karma Jambudi Yuktahi Palam Twaktwa Manishinha Janma Bandha Vinir Mukta Padam Gachan Chanamayam Karma Jam. Due to fruitive activities. So, there we go. Oops, went too far. Sorry. Go back. Karmajan, due to fruitive activities. Buddhi Yuktaha, being engaged in devotional service. He, certainly. Palam, results. Twaktwa, giving up. Manishinaha, great sages or devotees. Janma Bandha, from the bondage of birth and death. Vinir Muktaha, liberated. Padam, position. Kachanti, they reach. Anamayam, without miseries. Srila Prabhupada's translation. By thus engaging in devotional service to the Lord, great sages or devotees free themselves from the results of work in the material world. In this way, they become free from the cycle of birth and death and attain the state beyond all miseries by going back to Godhead. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The living entities belong to that place where there are no material miseries. The Bhagavatam 10.14.58 says, Samashrita ye pada palabha palam mahat padam punya yasho murare bhavam burir vatsa padam 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 yad vip padam natesham. That's a fun verse. I can imagine that would be a fun verse for children to learn, right? Why don't we say that? You say I'm mute, but why don't we say that together? Samashrita ye parapalava palam mahat padam punya yasho murare bhavam budhir vatsa padam 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 yad vi padam natesham. Translation of that verse. For one who has accepted the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, who is the shelter of the cosmic manifestation, and is famous as Mukunda, the giver of Mukti, the ocean of the material world is like the water contained in a calf's hoofprint. Padam padam, param padam, or the place where there is no material miseries or Vaikuntha is his goal, not the place where there is danger in every step of life. Owing to ignorance, one does not know that this material world is a miserable place where there are dangers at every step. Out of ignorance only, less intelligent persons try to adjust to the situation by fruitive activities, thinking that the resultant actions will make them happy. They do not know that no kind of material body anywhere within the universe can give life without miseries. The miseries of life, namely birth, death, old age, and disease, are present everywhere within the material world. But one who understands his real constitutional position as the eternal servitor of the Lord, and thus knows the position of the personality of Godhead, engages himself in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Consequently, he becomes qualified to enter into the Vaikuntha planets, where there is neither material, miserable life, nor the influence of time and death. To know one's constitutional position means to know also the sublime position of the Lord. One who wrongly thinks that the living entity's position and the Lord's position are on the same level is to be understood to be in darkness and therefore unable to engage himself in the devotional service of the Lord. He becomes a Lord himself and thus paves the way for the repetition of birth and death. But one who, understanding that his position is to serve, transfers himself to the service of the Lord, at once becomes eligible for Vaikuntha Loka. Service for the cause of the Lord is called Karma Yoga or Buddhi Yoga, or in plain words, devotional service to the Lord. Karma jam buddhi yuktahi palam twaktva manishinaha janma bandha vinir muktaha padam gacchantanan mayam. By thus engaging in devotional service to the Lord, great sages or devotees free themselves from the results of work in the material world. In this way, they become free from the cycle of birth and death and attain the state beyond all miseries by going back to Godhead. All right. So, Prabhupada makes the point in the purport that he makes often that materialistic people do not understand that material life is miserable and cannot be adjusted so that it's not miserable. In fact, I would say that we spend the majority of our time trying to adjust the material world to make it not miserable. Right? Or we're trying. we're trying. So, you know, it's too hot, you turn on the air conditioner, it's too cold, you turn on the heater, you put on some more clothes, you put on lighter clothes, you get lights, everything we're doing. We're adjusting with our body, we're adjusting with the temperature, we're adjusting with other relationships, we're adjusting with the politicians, we're constantly trying to adjust everything. And if we are honest, we'd have to say that the bulk of the time and energy of a conditioned soul is spent at trying to relieve the material miseries. That's the main thing that people are doing. As Prabhupada would often say, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That we're trying to get a nice, comfortable place to sleep. We're trying to get nice food to eat. We're trying to have a suitable, compatible romantic partner. And we're defending our ego. We're defending our physical body against bugs and snakes and bad weather and wars and viruses. And we're defending our false ego against anybody who dares to attack our false ego. And this is the main thing that we're doing with our time. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It just never ends. You finally realize it never ends. It just never ends. You never get to a point where you look around and go, no, everything's perfect, and then it stays that way. You know, a week later, a month later, whatever, and oh, this needs to be adjusted, this needs to be adjusted, and it just doesn't work. So the problem is not exactly the place. It's not when it was saying here, all right, Vinir Mukta Panam Gachanti Ananmayam. Gachanti means to go, to travel. So we may think that it's a question of traveling someplace else. Just like in the days before COVID, I was traveling constantly. And I was meeting, of course, many other people who were also traveling. And they were often traveling to try to find a more suitable place. People move to get a better home or a better climate or a better job. And so we may think that that's what we need to do. We need to get on a spaceship to go to Vaikuntha Loka. As Prabhupada says, by going back to Godhead, we get on a spaceship to go to Vaikuntha Loka. And then we go to a nice place and then we'll be happy. So that's like people thinking, you know, if I go to Hawaii, if I go to the Canary Islands, if I go to Tahiti, if I go to Mauritius, then I'll be happy. Go to some beautiful tropical place, or maybe they want to go to a ski resort or something. Huh? But as the saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. So the problem is not where geographically we are situated. The problem is our consciousness. If we have the proper consciousness, then we are back to Godhead even in this world. Because from one perspective, there is no material world. Prabhupada says that many times. There's no material world. Material world is a particular state of consciousness. As Krishna explains in the Chaturshloki, whatever appears to be of value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality, know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So the material world means a strange condition where I don't see things in relationship to Krishna. I see things as if they're separate from Krishna. I see that I'm separate from Krishna. I see other living beings as separate from Krishna. I see objects and endeavor as all separate from Krishna. And as soon as I do that, then I become miserable. An analogy we can give, it's just like if you are a guest in someone's house and you ignore them, and you ignore your relationship with them, and you are trying to be happy with the things in their house without dealing with them. So it would be a very uncomfortable situation. It wouldn't be a pleasant situation. Or, of course, Prabhupada gives the example, Urdhva Mulam in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, the upside-down banyan tree. And he says, if someone's hanging you upside down, I mean, people do hang upside down for exercise and yoga and stuff, but if you stay upside down, you're going to be very uncomfortable. Right? It's just, so when things are upside down, when they're out of harmony, then they're very uncomfortable. Another way of explaining it, which I give all the time, is that in the room I am in now, and I'm sure this is true for most of you, there is a door, at least one door, there is a window, and there are walls, unless some of you are outside. So there's a door and window and walls. And if you want to exit or enter the room, you use the door. If you try to use the window, I mean, for me, I'm on the ground floor, so it wouldn't be that big of a deal, but it would be uncomfortable to use the window, and I would definitely break something. And if you're on a higher floor, of course, then you may get severely injured if you try to use the window. If you try to use the wall, you will definitely get injured. So the misery is not done by the architect or the builder. The architect and the builder do not say, we are going to make walls so people can bang into them and bruise their forehead. And we are going to make windows so people can fall out of them. That's not their purpose. So when we try to use the world in a way it's not meant to be used, we suffer. It's not exactly that suffering is built into the world. When Krishna says, Dukhalayam Ashashvatam, this world is miserable and temporary, he's not exactly saying that suffering is built into the world. What he's saying is that if you're a materialistic consciousness, you're going to have a miserable temporary existence. It's just not going to work. You know, like a little child who's doesn't know how to navigate the world. You know, I spend time with my granddaughter's family, and they have two little boys. One of them is only 1 year old, and he doesn't know how to navigate the world. So, you know, he'll open a drawer and put his hand in it, and then close the drawer in his hand. And he does that all the time. Yeah, and even though he's done it 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times, he does it again. Opens a drawer, holds it, and then closes the drawer in his hand, and then he's crying. Right? Or he's trying to walk, and he bumps into things. He closes doors on his hand. He'll sit right by a door that someone opens and bumps in. Right? Because he doesn't understand, as Prabhupada talks about here in the purport, ignorance. He doesn't understand how to deal with the world in a way that will relieve his suffering. So a conditioned soul is like that. We don't understand, you know, why is my hand hurting? Like this baby, you know, he's closing the drawer on his hand, and he doesn't understand why he's in pain. So we are also like, why am I suffering? Why am I suffering? Why am I suffering? And we don't see how we are doing it to ourselves with the improper consciousness. So here Krishna is speaking about a method of changing our consciousness. A method of changing our consciousness, and he mentions two parts to the method and two results. So we've sort of kind of looked at the first result, that one will get freedom from miseries. And the second result actually is somewhat geographical, that one will go to another sphere. Because, well, we'll get there as to why. We'll get there a little later. Why we would move our location, even though we wouldn't need to anymore because our consciousness had changed. So why would we move our location? We'll hold on to that thought. Let's look at the process. Let's look at the process. So if we look back at the verse, we'll see it says, buddhi yuktaha. Buddhi yuktaha. And Srila Prabhupada, of course, as Srila Prabhupada does, is he explains this as basically bhakti. So Srila Prabhupada is saying this is buddhi yoga, or it could be called karma yoga, or devotional service. So Srila Prabhupada often conflates these different kinds of yoga. And Prabhupada is not really very interested in having people in the Kali Yuga try to take up different kinds of yoga. So he often has this tactic in his books. But let's look at the literal meaning for a minute. Buddhi yuktaha. Yukta means to join. And it's very similar to the word yoga, which is why Srila Prabhupada in the purport could say buddhi yoga. Because buddhi yukta and buddhi yoga mean very, very similar things. Yoga means to add. Like you'd say, two yoga, two is four. Adding things. And yukta is to bind, to connect. It's a little different than to add. But it's a very similar concept that I'm connecting things. I'm hooking up a trailer to my car. That's yukta. I'm attaching it. There's some kind of a hook. You attach one thing to another. So, buddhi yukta, to be attached with intelligence. To be attached with intelligence. Now, attached with intelligence to who or to what? You know, what does this mean? Let's unpack this a little bit. So, yuktaha means I'm attached to the Lord. I'm linked to the Lord. I'm linked to reality. I'm linked to truth. I'm connected to truth. Like we gave the example of the building. You know, how I'm dealing with the building is connected to the way the building is and the way the building is designed to be. So I'm yukta. And I'm connected with intelligence. Thank you for that. So I have to be, it's a problem with giving class on the computer and people contact you. If you were sitting on the Vyasa Center, you wouldn't know that there was an emergency going on here or there. So we're connected to the truth with intelligence. We have there's harmony. But people often talk about having harmony with the universe, which is nice. The universe is Krishna's body. You know, or being in harmony with the planet, being in harmony with nature. You know, and Prabhupada would always say, whose nature? It's God's nature. Now, this can be understood at a basic level as far as, like, the laws of nature are the laws of God. And we can understand something about the laws of God by looking at the laws of nature. You know, if we want to understand something about how to deal with our bodies, then we look medically and scientifically. How does the body work? How does the body function? You know, there's a lot that goes on in Kali Yuga where people work in a way that is opposed to how the body functions. Just like meat eating, you know, we can explain how our human body is not set up to digest meat. So if people are trying to eat meat, fish, and eggs in their human body, they'll become ill. Right? This is just, it's against biology. It doesn't work. You know, the whole system of, the whole ashram dharma system is a system of acting that's in accord with the natural biological processes that the body goes through during life. You know, when you're young, you want to study. When you're in the prime of life, you want to reproduce and create wealth. When you're older, you want to retire and travel. And when you're very old, you want to prepare for death and release yourself from the world. So this is the natural physiological and psychological stages of a human being. And to work with that is to be buddhi yukta. So you notice what's happening and you work with the laws of nature. So this is at a low level, you know, where you just become aware of biology and you become aware of physics and mathematics and chemistry, and which are some evidences of the will of God. The laws of mathematics, the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, the laws of biology. Like Prabhupada would say, the laws of nature. He would use that phrase quite a lot. The laws of nature, the laws of God. And you act in harmony with that. That's a kind of buddhi yuktaha. And people who work in harmony with the laws of nature have a lot less suffering than people who oppose the laws of nature. Isn't it a fact? I mean, right? If I eat food that's healthy for me, then I'm going to have less suffering than if I eat food that's not designed for this body. I mean, that's like, should be a duh. You know, if my sleeping patterns are in accord with biology, I'll be happier. My eating, my mating, my defending, all of these things are in accord with biology, in accord with what is natural and normal, then I will be happier. So that's on a very low level. And then we can go above that to the mind. And of course, buddhi is dealing with intelligence, the mind, the subtle body. So then if I link my subtle body to what is the will of God, I will be happier. If I act in it, if I change my mentality, I will be happier. And ultimately, if I bring myself, Prabhupada talks about our constitutional position in this purport, if I awaken my real self and link that with the Lord, then I will be happy. So bhakti yoga, of course, involves all three, body, mind, and soul, that I use my body in the service of the Lord. I go beyond just trying to live a natural life, but I use my body in the service of the Lord. I think of Krishna, manmana bhavamad bhakto, majaji mamnaraskaru. I'm always absorbing my mind, maya shakta manaparta, in the activities of Krishna. And I think of myself as his servant. And Srila Prabhupada writes about that quite a bit in this purport. How I develop this mood of being a servant. Because that is reality. Reality is that I'm a servant. Reality isn't that I'm a master. What can I master? I don't know. Any of you been able to master something? Absolutely. You know, even if I learn a skill very well, if I get sick, I can forget all of it. You know, my mind becomes disturbed by a fever, and then I don't even know anything anymore. So what kind of mastery do I have? But I'm always the servant. I have to serve my body. When my body says go to sleep, I can only keep it up so much longer. After a while, I have to say, okay, I'm going to sleep. Right? I can force my body to stay up until 2 or 3, and pretty soon I just can't do it anymore. Right? If our body says go use the toilet, what do they call it? The call of nature. Yeah, how long can you say no? You know, after a while, you're so busy with it. I don't want to go to the toilet. Yeah, that's why little children have accidents, because they don't want to stop playing. But eventually, you have to. You know, we have to breathe, we have to eat, we have to drink. We're the servants. We're the servant of this body. In many respects, we're the servant of our emotions. Our emotions tell us, get angry. Get greedy, get sad, get lusty, get whatever. And we go, yes. And people will even say, I am angry, as if it's their identity. I am sad. You know, it's quite interesting that, you know, that people actually identify and serve their emotions. And then, you know, we serve our false ego. That if I think someone has insulted me, or I think someone has cheated me, you know, then I become very offended. And I have to defend my honor. And, you know, and we have what's called honor cultures, where if anyone in the family does anything to upset the family honor, then they may be killed by their family members. So we're servants. We're servants of time. You know, you can dye your hair and you can put lots of cosmetics on your face. But you know what? an old person with dyed hair and cosmetics still looks like an old person. Sorry, even an old person with lots of plastic surgery. Who's that singer? Dolly Parton. So she's had tons of plastic surgery. She wears lots of makeup and she wears wigs, and you can still tell that she's old. It's very obvious. She's not 15. You know, maybe you might think she's 10 years younger than she is, but you know, we're servants. Time comes along, old age comes along, and we don't really have a choice. We are servants. So buddhi-yukta means, again, I link my intelligence with truth. I am a servant. And then I think, well, if I'm going to be a servant, why not be a servant of the best master? Like Srila Prabhupada talks about in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the idea of giving charity as being a segue to bhakti, that a person will think, well, if I'm sacrificing for a good cause, why do I sacrifice for the best cause? So this buddhi-yuktaha means that I want to use my body in harmony with truth, I want to use my mind in harmony with truth, and my very self, I want to see what is the truth of myself. I'm a servant. Now I realize, and I say this quite often, that as conditioned souls, we hate the idea of being a servant. We find it offensive. We find it abhorrent. You know, I've helped so many children with their education and had so many parent meetings with so many parents. I've never met a parent who says, you know, I want my child to grow up to be a servant. I haven't met such a parent. You know, even if the parent themselves is just like, you know, a janitor, that's not what they want for their child. They want their child to be a medical doctor or a lawyer or a president or something, you know. But an IT specialist, I don't know. But they don't want them to be a servant. But we are servants. And we're only going to be happy if we are who we are. That's just so obvious. I'm only going to be happy if I am who I am. I'm only going to be happy if how I'm acting is in harmony with how things are. I mean, it's such an ABC concept. It sounds ridiculous, but, you know, we don't get this. We think I'm going to be happy by adjusting the world to make it fit my fantasy of what I think it should be. I got this fantasy, as Prabhupada writes in this purport, that I'm the Lord, that I'm the master, that I'm the controller. I'm going to set up my life and the life of my dear, near and dear ones and the life of my country people and, you know, etc. to be what I want it to be, and I'm going to manipulate nature for that end, and then I will be happy. But that's, then we're untethered. We're like a mentally ill person, as Prabhupada, you know, had this booklet in the beginning of the movement. Who is crazy? Crazy! It's not that the way I'm going to stop getting bruises from the walls is to try to learn how to walk through the walls. That's not the solution. You know, well, let me develop a mystic power so that I can walk through a wall without getting bruised. No, the solution is to walk through the door and hang my pictures on the walls, not try to walk through the walls. That's the solution. So that's buddhi-yuktaha. I'm a servant. I am meant to be connected with the Lord in loving service. Me, the soul. I am meant to always think of the Lord in love, and I am meant to use my body in His service. And again, even if one does this at a lower level, you know, I want to dedicate myself to the good of the universe. Even then, one will be much happier than if one tries to be the Lord and Master of the material nature. Then we also have this very interesting thing here in the verse. We have palam twaktva. Now this is a common theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita, and it's a common theme throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, it's a common theme through all of the Vedic scriptures. Give up the fruits. Give up the fruits. Now, of course, giving up the fruits is connected to this idea of buddhi-yuktaha, but it's a particular subset of it. Now, why do I say that? because it's entirely possible, and please listen very carefully because this is a very important point, it's entirely possible to think I'm serving the Lord and still be attached to the fruits of my work. That's entirely possible. I could be on a physical and mental level and in the mood of a servant, thinking, you know, working for the benefit of Krishna and working for to do things for Krishna and be very attached to the fruits. It's entirely possible, and I know that from my own personal experience. Now, how do we know that we're attached to the fruits? We know when things don't go right. You know, you spend months or years working on something for Krishna, working with the laws of nature, working with Krishna's laws, working with the scriptures. You're connected with your intelligence to Krishna, and you work really hard for something, whatever it is, building a new temple, building a barn for the cows, taking care of 20 cows, starting a business for Krishna, whatever it is. And then something happens. Something goes wrong. And especially if something goes wrong from the other devotees. So, you know, there you are, 90% done with building your temple, and some other devotees come along and criticize what you're doing. Or stop you. You know, you can't finish the last 10% of your building. And sometimes that even happens when, you know, some devotee authority asks you to do something, and you do it, and you spend a lot of time and effort and maybe money, and then after you've done it, the devotee authority says, oh, we don't want it. Forget it. We're not going to use it. Or, I mean, this happened actually to my father very early in my joining ISKCON. So I joined the temple in Chicago, and we were going to have our first Rath Yatra in the summer of 1974. So my father ran a multinational food business, and we were going to cook a whole feast to serve at Rath Yatra. We needed some huge pots. We needed some really big pots. So my father had these huge pots from his factory, and he agreed to loan us one or two of these pots. They were so large that they had to be transported by train. So he arranged to loan us these pots and to transport them by train to Chicago. And then after that was done, the devotees found out that the city would not allow us to serve hot food, that we didn't have the proper licenses and the proper safety and health requirements to serve hot food, that we could only serve cold food. So we never used the pots. You know, all the time and trouble and expense my father used to transport them, it was useless. You know, he simply had to transport them back. And this kind of thing happens. You know, we're asked to do something. The person asking us to do something doesn't do their own homework and research or whatever, or they change their mind or something, you know, and we do all this and then it's all for naught. Then how do we feel? How do we feel? Do we feel depressed? Do we feel discouraged? Do we feel angry? Do we just say, you know, well, I'm not going to do anything anymore. What's the use of doing anything anymore? Nothing that I do turns out right. You know, that mentality shows that we have some attachment to the fruit. Or this can also happen on a subtle level, where, you know, we do something and it does work out successfully, but nobody acknowledges us. You know, everything's great, but nobody thanks us. Maybe they get up and thank everybody else and they don't thank us. You know, again, I'm sure we've had this sort of experience. We're like, hey, what about me? I had this experience recently in teaching an online class where we thanked a lot of people. I had actually twice in the last few years, each time with a very senior devotee. And, you know, we thanked a lot of people, and then the very senior person said, what about me? You didn't thank me. I did this and this and this. And I thought, wow, you know, it's what we're like. We want to be acknowledged. You know, naturally we want to be acknowledged. But then we can see again that we have some attachment to the fruit, that we're trying to enjoy the fruit. And if we don't get to enjoy the fruit, it's difficult for us. Yes? Now, you could also see from these examples that our desire to enjoy the fruit is the cause of suffering. Just like our unlinking our intelligence from nature is a cause of suffering, because I walk into walls instead of doors. So my being attached to the fruit is a cause of suffering, because I am not absolutely in control of the fruit. I'm just not. I always give the example of the cherry trees we had in our yard in Detroit, that as soon as the cherries ripened, the birds ate them. It was very difficult for us to get ripe cherries. You know, we're just not. We're one of the five factors of action. So we're not in control of the fruit. And many, many times when we do something, we work hard and there is no fruit, or the fruit is rotten, or the fruit is taken and enjoyed by somebody else. Or we get the fruit and we enjoy it, but it's not what we thought it would be. That's also very common. You know, you get the girl of your dreams, you get the boy of your dreams, and then you find out that maybe they were a nightmare. You know, that kind of thing happens. You get the house of your dreams, you find that it was a nightmare. I mean, I've seen that too. You buy a new house, and it turns out that the place is falling apart. So it's quite common that, you know, even we get the fruit and we try to enjoy it, and it's not enjoyable. And so this leads to a lot of misery and frustration. It leads to a lot of suffering. And it can lead, a fruit of mentality leads to a very peculiar life, where one is not enjoying in the moment, one is focused on future happiness. So I'm sacrificing now, I'm suffering now for the hope of a future of enjoyment. And when the time comes for me to reap the harvest of my hard work, a lot of the times I'm frustrated and angry and unhappy for the reasons that we just discussed. And so when am I actually happy in that kind of mentality? I'm only happy when I get the result and it's what I wanted it to be. And then it's brief. Then it's temporary. And so then I have to strive again. Now, please also note this point very carefully. This fruit of mentality is very much based on a pride of being the doer, ahankara vimutta makarta hamiti manyate. That I take pride in the sacrifices that I'm making to achieve the goal. I mean, it's sort of interesting that we often get more of a sense of enjoyment out of sacrificing and suffering for a goal rather than a goal that we could achieve very easily. So, you know, we have this pride of our austerity and our sacrifice and our hard work to achieve the goal. And I believe we take some kind of strange idea of pleasure from it, because otherwise there's so little pleasure in materialistic life. So, you know, I'm going to take pleasure from my suffering. You know, we sort of realize that, all right, I'm spending like 90% of my time suffering, going through austerity and difficulty and sacrifice to achieve this goal. And then when I get the goal, there's only a small portion of the time that I actually get to enjoy it. So, you know, I'm having just a minuscule portion of my life engaged in actually anything called enjoyment. All right, then I'll revel in my sacrifice, but in an egotistical way. I'm such a sacrificer. I'm such a hard worker. You know, a devotee the other day recommended a book, How to Get Twice the Amount of Work Done in Half the Time. You know, and I said, well, actually, I already know how to do that. But, you know, we end up being proud of that kind of thing. You know, I can do the work of five people. I can get twice the amount of work done in half the time. And I work so hard for this. And we often tell people how hard we worked, how much we sacrifice. It's one of the main things that we do. We talk about our austerities. We do this in our relationships. You know, oh, I was in the kitchen for 6 hours today making this, and I had to go to a specialty shop and buy this thing, and, you know, and we tell people that. Or, yeah, at work I had this problem and that problem, the other problem. Or the kids were doing this and the kids were doing that. Why are we doing that? Why are we giving a litany of our yajnas? I remember once visiting a temple where the woman was telling me, yeah, you know, I always let all the visiting preachers and sannyasis stay in my house, and I'd be in the kitchen 14 hours a day. And I'm thinking, why are you telling me this? Why are you giving me this list of your austerities? You know, and that's not joy. It's an egotistical thing. And it's so that we feel that we can claim a right to the fruits, that I've earned it. You know, therefore, I should enjoy it. Therefore, you should get out of my way. Therefore, you should treat me nicely. Therefore, you should reciprocate with me, and so forth. But, oh, awful. What an awful consciousness. What an awful way to live. So giving up the fruits, as Krishna says later in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that Twajakchanti Kalevaram, that at the end of this, of tyaga, at the end of giving up the fruits, you find peace. So it seems counterintuitive. It seems like everything I want to enjoy in this world, I'll work hard for it and then I'll enjoy it. And Krishna says, no, if you stop trying to enjoy this world, you'll find peace. So how does one work without an attachment to the fruit? Because this is, Arjuna will ask this question over and over again in the Bhagavad Gita, that, well, if I'm supposed to give up the fruits of work, why work? It sounds to people like work, but don't take your paycheck. That's what it sounds like to people. It's like, okay, I'm going to put in 40 hours or 50 hours even, plus, you know, once the world goes back to normal, my commute time, everybody I'm sure is looking forward to their commuting time again. So, you know, I'm going to put in all those hours, 8 hours a day, an hour for lunch, plus my commute time. I'm going to have to deal with obnoxious people. I'm going to have to deal with things I don't like and so forth. And I'm going to do this without a paycheck. How am I going to pay my rent? How am I going to pay for my food? How am I going to pay for my whatever, Netflix? You know, I mean, why would I do that? It just seems stupid. You know, even if I'm Bill Gates' son and I don't need to work, you know, I might want to work in a volunteer organization so that I can get my plaque up on my name on a plaque on the wall, or, you know, people will honor me at a big dinner or something. Why would I work without that? So it's sort of confounding to the conditioned soul to give up the fruits of your work. But what it means is that one works with this, going back to the Buddha Yuktaha, one works with this connection to the Lord at every moment. And that's a different kind of fruit. That's a different kind of result. And this takes practice, therefore we call it sadhana bhakti or abhyas yoga. It takes practice. We're so habituated to doing things that make us miserable. So it takes practice. That the joy I'm getting, as Prabhupada says, the very end of Bhagavad Gita, we live life with the thrill, not just one time, but at every moment. The joy that we're getting is, in this moment, I'm connecting with the Lord. 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 And then the fruit becomes the same as every other moment. You know, and I'm sure we've all had this kind of experience, where, you know, I'm cooking for Krishna, and the experience of cooking for Krishna is just as joyful as eating the prasadam. You know, shopping for Krishna, cooking for Krishna, offering it to Krishna, and cleaning the Lord's plate and taking the prasadam are all equally blissful. And we know we have that experience when sometimes we don't eat what we cooked, and it's still blissful. It doesn't matter. You know, you cook for some big festival and all the prasadam is being served out while you're cleaning the kitchen, and the person you asked to make you a plate forgets to make you a plate, and you get out and there's only like two preps left. And it doesn't matter, because you're so happy from the cooking for Krishna that you weren't cooking to eat. Again, we've all had this sort of experience where the process was as enjoyable as the result. You know, the result, again, it was just another moment that was equal to every other moment in the process. And each one of them was, each moment was thrilling. And this way we're peaceful because our enjoyment no longer depends on whether or not the end result is successful. Which, as I say, we can't control that. I mean, good luck. But what I found is I can't control it. I can't control, does something happen? How good is it when it happens? How much do I like it when it happens? How much do other people appreciate that it happens? How long does it go on? You know, I can't control any of that. All I can control is my intention and my desire. That's really all I can control. So anyway, this way one becomes peaceful, and it takes practice. We have a long habit of thinking that we're the controller. We have a long habit to identifying our happiness as something egotistical and something enjoying the fruit. This is a long, long-standing habit. So we shouldn't be surprised if we fail in this over and over and over again. But we keep trying, we keep trying, we keep trying, we keep trying. Just like the little child who doesn't understand about sticking their fingers in the drawers. But then, you know, we don't generally do that as adults. Maybe sometimes, but generally not. Whereas my little great-grandson is doing it every day. You know, we get to the point that we understand. So as we get this experience of working with that attachment to the fruit, and we're like, oh, wow, that was nice. Wow, that was really nice. And we get another experience of working with that attachment to the fruit. Like, oh, that's very nice. And Krishna explains this in a way that perhaps we haven't so much appreciated when he talks to the gopis at the beginning of Rasleela. And he says to them, I cannot repay my debt to you. So the acharyas explain that Krishna cannot repay his debt because the gopis have given up their reputation and their families. They've given up everything. And Krishna hasn't given up anything. So Krishna hasn't walked out on, you know, Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj, or he has not made the kind of sacrifices that the gopis have made for him. He has not given up all of his other relationships. They've given up all of their relationships. So Krishna says that I cannot fulfill my yetamam prapadyante tamsatayva bhajamyam. I cannot reciprocate with you. I cannot give to you what you give to me. Of course, that's a little fallacious, because when a jiva gives everything to Krishna and Krishna gives everything to that jiva, what Krishna is giving is a gazillion, billion, infinite times greater than whatever the jiva could give. So Krishna is being a little tongue-in-cheek here, because clearly he can... I mean, reciprocate isn't even the word for it. I give Krishna everything, and Krishna gives me everything. It's like I give him a little tiny, you know, cup, and he gives me an ocean. So, you know, that's kind of silly. But still, Krishna is humble, actually. And he's grateful. Krishna's grateful. So he says like that. He says, I cannot reciprocate. You've given me more than I've given to you. Krishna does not have a mood of entitlement, interestingly enough. If anybody could have a mood of entitlement, it would be him, but he doesn't. He has a mood of gratitude. And then Krishna says something very astonishing. He said, you should be satisfied with your own love for me. This is the mood of working without attachment to the fruit. And this concept is understood at one level, just like we were saying, linking is understood at one level, that I should work in harmony with the planet or in harmony with nature. So this concept of being satisfied with my own love is understood also by people who are not bhakti yogis, by people who are in gyan yoga and karma yoga and dhyan yoga, where they'll say, be happy with what you can give. So instead of this mood of self-sacrificing, one has this mood that everything I give is a gift. And I'm not expecting anything in return. I'm happy by the giving. So not that the husband is thinking, you know, or whatever. When spouse is thinking, I work so hard, and when I come home, I expect my partner to just be so grateful for how hard I've worked. But instead, you know, with this mood of self-sacrificing and then trying to enjoy the fruit. But instead, I work so hard as a gift. Now, even on a low mundane level, you know, I work so hard as a gift for my spouse. It's just a gift. There were no strings attached. It wasn't a merchant exchange. It was just a gift. And ultimately, of course, we should do that not on a mundane level, but for Krishna. You know, I'm doing this work as a gift to Krishna, not because I'm paying for a fruit. And my happiness comes in my own giving of love. Now, we all experience this. We all experience where the act of giving is in and of itself its own reward. We all experience this. Doing something kind, going out of our way to do something kind and nice and considerate for someone, that the feeling we get from doing that is its own reward. Whether the other person knows about it, whether they appreciate it, it's irrelevant. I'm giving class. Sorry. So we all have that kind of experience. And what to speak of if we're doing something for Krishna. You know, if I have that experience that watering a little plant that's wilting, or, you know, feeding a stray puppy dog is satisfying just for the act of giving, then how much more so that would be true if I'm giving to Krishna. And it's not that Krishna, by telling us, right, that we should give up the fruit, palam tvatva, that Krishna is asking us to work without pleasure. You know, it translates to us that, well, all I'm going to have left is my hard work. But actually, you won't have any hard work at all. Because instead of labeling it as hard work, and instead of labeling it as self-sacrifice, one labels it as gift-giving and an act of love. Now, we should say that it's much easier to do that if we're doing work that is our nature. And if I'm doing work voluntarily, as Prabhupada's saying, individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. So if I'm doing work under compulsion, if I'm doing work that I don't enjoy at all, that's not in accord with my nature, that doesn't fit me, then doing this is extremely difficult. And not even advised by the Lord. You know, some devotees think that a real surrendered person does things that they hate for Krishna. Sometimes we have to do things that we hate. It's just the nature of life. But generally, Krishna's talking about surrendering means I know what my nature is, and I use that for Krishna. I use my nature for Krishna. And it's not really that hard to enjoy the process of giving when I'm using my nature for Krishna. I mean, I can just think of a simple example in my own life. So we're just at the end now of the Bhakti Shastri course here in North Carolina. And my daughter wanted to have PowerPoints for each class. So I wouldn't have done it if she hadn't asked for it. I would have just gone with written notes, but she wanted the PowerPoints. And she was making the first few. And then she said, "This is taking me so long." And I said, "Well, you know, I know how to do that. I'll do it." Well, but I love doing things like that. I love taking complex ideas, especially from Shastra, and organizing them so that they're easy to understand and easy to teach. And then I love adding the right illustrations and putting the text together with the illustrations in an attractive way. I just love doing things like that. It just suits the kind of person that I am. Not the kind of person that I am ultimately in my spiritual body, but it suits the kind of person that I am in this life, in this world. It uses my joys, it uses my talents, it makes me feel like I'm doing something that's a really good fit for me. I'm a square peg in a square hole kind of thing. And then I'm seeing that it's helping others, that it's meaningful, it's bringing me deeper into the Shastra. So I'm enjoying doing these PowerPoints as much as I enjoy teaching the PowerPoints or having the students learn from the PowerPoints. I'm enjoying the process. So, again, I'm sure we all have an experience like that, where when I'm doing things that are in accord with my nature, I'm enjoying the process. Again, this is true even for materialistic people. So if a materialistic person is working according to their nature, they will enjoy the process, regardless of the result. It's called a state of flow. However, if I'm acting according to my nature for Krishna, then I have a spiritual enjoyment of the process. I enjoy the process of giving. I don't feel I need to get anything back because the process of giving was in itself its own reward. And this is what Krishna is telling the gopis. The process of your loving me is its own reward, however I reciprocate with you. And so that's why the gopis are even happy, although externally it doesn't look like that, but that's why the gopis are even happy when Krishna leaves them and goes to Mathura. It's a different flavor of ecstasy, but it's still ecstasy. Why? Because their happiness is coming from their own giving of love. And they're giving love whether Krishna's in Vrindavan or Krishna's in Mathura. Doesn't matter. That's their own giving. Their love is not dependent on a particular type of reciprocation or fruit from Krishna, which is, of course, nicely explained in the last verse of the Shikshastra. All right, so what does one get if one does this? If one does buddhi yuktaha, and one does pala tvaktva. If one links with intelligence, and one renounces fruits. So here we have freedom from miseries. Freedom from miseries. We have said here specifically, janma bandha vinir mukta. So you get free from the bondage of birth. Muktaha means free. Param gacchanti anmayam. So you get to a place, padam is a place, gacchanti is to go, anamayam, without miseries. So these two results here are very much talking about changing one's literal position. That I don't go into another material body to take birth, and instead I, the soul, go to another place. I go to a place where there's no miseries. And this particular way of explaining the goal sounds very death-oriented. You know, you're doing this process within life of buddhi yuktaha and palatvaktva, and then what happens is, at the end of life, you go to this wonderful place and you don't have to come back to the material world. And this sort of a concept is there, of course, in all the religions of the world. That at the time of death, you go to some sort of a heaven, and you don't have to suffer anymore. Now we should note, however, as I alluded to in the beginning, that it's not simply a matter of changing my location, my geographical location. My people think if I go to Tahiti or Hawaii or someplace, I'll be happy. Because it's actually a matter of consciousness. Now, if I have the proper consciousness, then even in this body, even in this world, I will not experience misery. Externally, in this body and in this world, the miseries are not going to stop. Externally, in this body and in this world, I'm still going to get a toothache, I'm still going to get old, you know, I'm still going to have somebody insult me, and you know, there's going to be viruses circling the planet, and that's not going to stop if my consciousness changes. However, I will not experience those things as miserable. Why? Because I'll be working in harmony with nature. I'm in harmony with reality, and I see that reality is benevolent. When I'm in harmony with nature, I see that everything that happens to me is benevolent. There's nothing malevolent. That Krishna's in control. Bhoktaram Yogatapa Samsarvalokmaheshram Suvidam Sarvabhutanam Gyatramam Shanti Vichiti. I see he's controlling everything and he's my friend. Like the trusting child understands that the parents are benevolent. And if the parent takes away the toy or the parent makes you take some bitter tasting medicine, you may not understand that when you're 2, but you certainly understand that when you're 12. That, you know, my parents are benevolent, and if they're asking me to go to school or they're asking me to do this, that is for my benefit. If you have good parents, obviously. So, you know, Krishna is a very good parent. And so how is one miserable if one sees that everything is loving? And also one's not miserable because one is getting this thrill at every moment from connecting with the Lord, regardless of what goes on externally. So one will not be miserable here. But also, and I said in the beginning that we would discuss this, the different places, the different geographical places, although in one sense the spiritual world is beyond space, but the different geographical places correspond to different types of consciousness. So according to our consciousness, we're attracted to certain places, and according to our consciousness, we're allowed to go to certain places. And that's true in this world also. You know, there's restaurants and that only allow people in if they're dressed a certain way and they behave a certain way. Right? There's all sorts of things in this world where you're allowed to participate according to your demeanor. And if you have the wrong demeanor, you're not allowed to participate. You know, going from one country to another, you have to have certain qualifications to get into the country. But even, you know, to work at a job or to be inside of a shop, one has to behave in a certain way in order to get in, and one has to behave in a certain way in order to stay there. And then there's so many clubs and associations of different kinds where one has to have a certain mentality in order to be part of that association, part of that club. And Prabhupada gives this example all the time. He says, I needed to have a visa to come to America. Why don't you need to have a visa to go to the higher planets? You can't just barge in, you know. I mean, you know, in America we have some difficulty that people without the proper visas, they're so anxious to get to our wealthy country, our relatively wealthy and relatively crime-free country, that they're trying to come in illegally. You know, and in our countries, a lot of those people don't get caught. Of course, then they have to live their lives in fear, which is not a very pleasant thing. But a lot of those people don't get caught. But when it comes to the universe, that doesn't happen. You know, when Vishwamitra tried to send that low-grade person to heaven, Indra stopped him. I forget what his name was. And so the guy was hanging in space upside down. Because Vishwamitra is trying to push him to heaven, and Indra's pushing him down, and the guy was hanging upside down in outer space. And finally, Vishwamitra said, okay, I'll make my own heaven for him. So Vishwamitra created his own heavenly planets for this guy. But Indra was saying, you know, we can't let him into heaven. He's a low-class person. I was just actually reading this in the 8th canto. How, you know, the demons can't, they can't, they're always trying to get into heaven. But they can't because they don't let people like that in there. Sorry, we're not going to let you in. So the spiritual world is a place for people who already have spiritual consciousness, is the point. It's not that if I have material consciousness that I'm going to go to the spiritual world. I remember Ridhananda Maharaj making this point that if you take a bunch of materialists and you take them for Vaikuntha, they'll just look around and go, what are the Hare Krishnas doing here? You know, they won't actually be able to appreciate it. It's not just the place. And they won't have the proper mentality. So if we're in the proper consciousness, then we're already back to home, back to Godhead, even in this body. And then the transition from this life to the next life is seamless. Like Narada said, lightning and illumination occurring simultaneously. That we're already in the proper state of consciousness. And therefore, we naturally end up going to the place and with the other beings who have a similar consciousness to ourselves. And of course, there is a specific place where there is no more even external misery. So in this world, we can have a consciousness of not suffering, although there are the external miseries do not cease. But ultimately then, we end up in a position where not only do we have the consciousness, but there are not even any external difficulties from any perspective. So we have a little bit of time for questions and comments and discussions. Srila Prabhupada dealt with his own body, there was no fear. I mean, you have a lot of devotees who remarked on that. The way Prabhupada moved his hands, the way he walked. You know, and a lot of times people would think they were talking about something mystical. And Prabhupada's floating. You know, and I think there probably was something mystical, just like Prabhupada would walk for an hour and a half a day, but his feet never got calluses on them. So there probably was something mystical that he actually wasn't touching the ground. I think that is most likely the case. But it wasn't just something mystical like that. That Prabhupada had this mood of, and this was the main thing I noticed when I first met Srila Prabhupada, of total authenticity. That he was totally there. He was totally who he was. He didn't care what you thought of him. His identity wasn't based on what anybody else thought of him. He wasn't looking for appreciation or accolades or any kind of anything like that. He was who he was, and he was happy and satisfied in who he was. And then just this very childlike simplicity, at the same time, incredible sophistication. So, you know, this wisdom, sophistication, and you know, mature wisdom with this childlike simplicity and authenticity. And this utter fearlessness and this utter love. And it was evident. It was evident in how he sat. It was evident in how he moved his hands. In everything that he did, you just, you know, you notice it, and you were wondering what you were noticing. It was so unusual that it was hard to understand. What am I noticing about how Srila Prabhupada moves? And when his demeanor, how he looks at people. A lot of people would say that you felt that Prabhupada was looking right through you and he knew everything about you, for example. Many devotees would say that. But it was this love of God that was permeating everything about him. So any contact with him would have a spiritual effect. A contact with his clothing, his food remnants, his anything, would have a spiritual effect. So in that sense, it was spiritual. I can give you another analogy, an interesting analogy. I've told this story before. So actually down the street from where I am now, we used to run a Gurukul school. And we had a Gurukul school in that building, I'm not sure how long, 8 years, 10 years, something like that. So Gurukul school in the building meant that every single day, and it was not just the regular sadhana you find in a devotee's house where we're doing worship every day and offering our food, but, you know, every single day, except for vacations, you know, we're all reciting verses. You've got, like, you know, 30 kids singing the Bhagavad Gita and singing the Brahma Samhita for years. It's going on there. So at a certain point, that school closed, and we were selling the building. We'd taken everything out of the building. The building was just it was nothing in there. No furniture, nothing. And I was staying next door. We were trying to sell the place, so people were coming to look at it. And that was the time that I was working in a public school, in a government school, as part of my doctorate. So I was wearing, like, a business suit, and I come back from the school, and I see these two guys, in the 30s, 40s maybe, walking around the property. I said, what are you doing here? And one of them said, well, I was here this morning to look at the building with a realtor, and I wanted to bring my friend this afternoon. He said, I know it's probably closed. I didn't know if I could get in, but I really wanted to bring my friend to show him this property. And I said, why is that? And he said, I've never experienced an energy like this before anywhere. So, you know, I let them in the building, and they were just like, wow, what is this place? And I was not obviously dressed as a devotee. And I was just thinking, you know, this building has been empty for maybe a year. You know, but still somehow that energy of all of this japa and kirtan and shlokas, and it was like it was in the walls or something. So the building, although it was a physical, is a physical building made of bricks and wood and concrete like anything else, the building had a spiritual effect. So we see this in the bodies of great devotees, that their bodies have a spiritual effect. And therefore we can say their bodies have been spiritualized, at the same time, the person's own eternal spiritual body is being awakened from within and operating within and no longer using the subtle body. So that's a very long answer, but I hope that that's a satisfying answer. We have about 5 more minutes if anyone else has a question.
I have a question. I wanted you to talk a little bit more about, it sounded to me like a sort of a ugly character trait when someone expects a thank you. I know of someone who was invited to a wedding, but because of COVID, they did not go, but they did send a generous financial gift, and they never got any kind of, not a little thank you note or nothing. So, sometimes I think it might be hard to let go of those fruits, but I wanted you to talk a little bit more about why that's such a terrible character trait.
I don't think I would characterize it as a terrible character trait, but it makes us miserable. It makes us miserable. How do we feel when I give a generous financial gift to somebody and they don't send a thank you? I feel miserable. My happiness then becomes dependent on how other people treat me. And the last time I checked, I cannot control how other people treat me. I mean, I don't know. I keep trying. Don't ask me why I keep trying to control how other people treat me. But so far it hasn't worked. I mean, I'm hopeful maybe tomorrow it will work. But, so far it hasn't worked. And if I make my happiness dependent on how other people treat me, what other people think of me, what other people say of me, I'm going to be miserable. First of all, I'm going to be constantly in fear because I know that in the past other people have not treated me nicely or they haven't treated people that I love nicely. So I figure that's going to repeat itself in the future, and it probably will. So I'm always going to be afraid of it. Then I'm going to be trying to manipulate people to treat me in a certain way, which is generally not going to work. So I'm going to feel very frustrated. I'm going to feel very angry with them. I wouldn't say it's a terrible character trait. It's just miserable. It's like if you walk into walls, that's not a terrible character trait, but it's just dumb. Just Robert uses the word ignorance. It's ignorant. All right. So, why am I giving a substantial financial gift to somebody? So they'll appreciate me. So they'll love me. And then I'll be happy. And then I'll feel fulfilled. Then maybe I should get a different motive. Now, it's true that if somebody is regularly ungrateful with me, I might decide that it would be more prudent to give my gifts elsewhere. I have a limited amount of gifts that I can give. I mean, I once gave some very expensive jewelry that I'd gotten from my mother to a friend, and years later I found it on the floor of her house covered with dust mixed with her children's toys. And I decided, I'm not going to give her expensive jewelry anymore. Jesus said, don't throw your pearls before swine. And we say, don't teach the glories of the Lord to the faithless. It's actually an offense to give something to ungrateful people. We implicate them in offense when we give something to ungrateful people. So if people are ungrateful, then give to somebody else. But my happiness shouldn't be dependent on other person's gratitude. It may be a pragmatic decision that I may just say, why should I give something to someone who doesn't use it properly? I mean, it's just, why? Let me give something to somebody who uses it properly. But it's a pragmatic choice. It's not an emotional choice. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So where is my happiness going to come from then? I got to get happiness, and under my abhisat, I'm a pleasure-seeking being. I've got to find happiness. So that my happiness can be that I'm doing this to please Krishna. Would Krishna like it if I gave these people a substantial financial gift? Would that make Krishna happy? If it would make Krishna happy, then whether or not those people are grateful is not my problem. That's their problem. That's their problem in their relationship with Krishna. Again, pragmatically, I may decide I have a limited amount of money, I have a limited amount of time, I have a limited amount of energy. You know, let me use it for where it's going to have the most value, if I can. But again, that's again to please Krishna. That's again to please Krishna. I mean, that if we think about the story with Jesus and the money, where the parable that Jesus told, where a master gave his three servants money. One servant, he gave one coin. One he gave, I think, five, and one he gave 10. I don't remember exactly. And he comes back after some time, and the one to whom he gave 10, he invested it, he got back 100 coins. The one to whom he gave 5, he invested it, he got 10 coins. And the one to whom he gave 1, he buried it in the ground. And the master said to the one who'd buried it in the ground, okay, we're going to take it up, and you lose it. You don't have anything. And to the ones who'd increased it, he said, well done, good and faithful servant. So we should try to give whatever gifts the Lord has given to us, we should try to share them in such a way that they will multiply. We should try to share them in ways that will, we should try to make good investments of the gifts that the Lord gave us for his happiness. So he will say, well done, good and faithful servant. Whether or not other people appreciate that, you know. And I like the, I'll just end with this, I like the, when Akura goes to Vrindavan, and he says, therefore, Krishna Balaram will say, Uncle, Akura, and my whole life will be successful. And Prabhupada said, if we're not working to be recognized by Krishna, our whole life is condemned. So to take that tendency to want to be thanked and appreciated by others and want to be appreciated by Krishna.
Can I ask you something? Many times I postpone decisions because I really would like Krishna to tell me how he feels about what decision I'm making. How would I know if you will please him?
One of the questions I get all the time, we're kind of running out of time.
You're saying that we are psychological motivated, and if this woman gives, you know, a big substantial gift to these people, because she wants to feel loved. But if you want to please Krishna, how exactly go about knowing this right?
Very good. All right. So I'll try to answer this very quickly because it's already past our time. Is that all right? Can I answer it?
Yes.
And I'm asking the leader. Is that okay? All
right. For sure.
Okay. So first of all, we have Guru Sadhu Shastra. So I know what pleases Krishna from what's in the Shastra. There's indications in the Shastra about gift giving, since you're asking that. So I can look at Shastra. Now, but Shastra is going to give general instructions. So then I look at the examples of sadhus. How do other saintly persons behave in these situations? And I can use that as a model. Then I may also have the instructions of guru. Now, that doesn't mean that you should bother your guru 100 times a day about every little thing. You know, my dear guru, should I put on, you know, green socks or gray socks today? Which would be more pleasing to Krishna? You know, your guru will not be pleased with that. But still, Guru is going to be able to give you general directions specifically for you. So one thing is you've got this boundary of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So it's not going to please Krishna to, you know, push children off the roof of a building or kill cows or, you know, work for the mafia. So you've got to be within this Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. All right, so that's objective. And that, of course, means you have to know Shastra. And that means you have to know what the saintly persons do, and it means you have to be trained by guru. That's not something you're going to understand in 5 minutes. So some training. That's objective. Subjective is how do you feel. So I like Bhagavad Gita 9.2. Right? Raja Vidya Raja Yuyam Pavitram Idamuttamam Pratyaksha Vagamam Dhammam Susukam Parkarkam Adyuyam. Raja Vidya, do you feel full of knowledge when you do it? Rajaguyam, do you understand the essence of things? Pavitram, do you feel purified? Dharmyam, do you feel like you're getting something authentic? Susukam, are you feeling happy? Really happy and joyful. That's subjective. Another somewhat subjective, somewhat kind of objective-subjective mix is Bhagavad Gita 12, 13 through 20, where Krishna says how people behave if they're pleasing him. So if you're not sure whether or not something's going to please Krishna, you can also look at that list, 13 through 20, text 13 through 20 of chapter 12. If what you're doing is in that kind of a category, then it's pleasing to Krishna. So, you know, Krishna talks about sacrifice, charity, and austerity should never be given up. He talks about those things in each of the modes, especially in chapter 17 and 18 in the Bhagavad Gita. So you can see that doing those things in sattva is going to be pleasing to Krishna. So you've got a lot of guidance there about what's pleasing to Krishna. But subjectively also, you should feel in touch with knowledge, feel in touch with the essence of things, feel that you're being very authentic, you should feel that you're being very joyful, you should feel that you're being purified. And both of those, not just the subjective, not just the objective, but you put those two things together and you'll have a very good handle on whether or not Krishna's pleased. Krishna's not going to make that mysterious. You know, Krishna's not going to tell you over and over again, work to please me, and then say, well, you're just going to have to guess how to do that. You know, he's going to be specific about it. All right, we definitely should end here, but thank you very much for this opportunity. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.